Hello and welcome to Oxford Today on Oxide Radio. This is Theo Davis-Lewis once again, talking to some of the most interesting people around the university and in the city. And I always talk about who you've had on the programme before, at the start of everything. I think I'm not going to do that, because I'm going to go straight into the guests with an S at the end. I've got, today, I've got Bethany White and Alice Park in here, who are the co-producers of the Women in Oxford's History podcast, which seeks to highlight the contribution of women to life in the university. Both are currently PhD students. Alice studies archaeology with an interest in art, museums and heritage, and Bethany studies modern history with a focus on working class women and education. Welcome both to the show.
Thank you very much for having me.
So, if I can start, Bethany, by sort of talking about the story of your involvement with this and explaining what this podcast is, because some people perhaps haven't heard of it and will not know, you know, the purpose of it. Because we've had people on this show, Pamela Roberts is one of the example, who's focused on actually improving black representation in Oxford and black figures. So is this a similar sort of initiative, women's voices and raising their profile in the university?
Yeah, absolutely. So it was actually founded in 2016, I think, by two PhD students, Alison Moulds and Olivia Robinson. And they launched an initial series, which was six episodes, and they brought in researchers from across the university who had come across women in their own work and wanted to highlight them. So I was actually one of those researchers. I'd come across a woman in my PhD research, and I came in and talked about her. And then in the summer of 2017, Olivia and Alison moved on to kind of finish up their PhDs and recruited for some more producers, and that's when I stepped in, and Alice as well.
Yeah.
So the podcast really, yeah, I think it was founded initially to highlight the contributions of women to Oxford, and I think it's worth clarifying as well, it's not just Oxford University, but Oxford as a whole, so we like to look at town and gown, as it were, and trying, yeah, to kind of right the imbalance that's kind of focused so heavily on men to date.
Now, has that come then, looking at your own PhD theses and looking at what you've actually focused on your own career in academia, has that academic side actually influenced somewhat, this is sort of a, I hesitate to say it's a sort of a political initiative, but like, it's influenced your sort of convictions as well, the academic side of your work?
Yeah, I agree. If you look at what my PhD is on, which is sort of aspects of art in ancient Greece, you might...
Warrior women, yes.
I'm looking at images of Amazons in antiquity, and I think that's kind of the strongest link between the two. One of the things that has been of extreme interest to me throughout my academic career is women in the ancient world. And one of the most frustrating things about studying women in the ancient world is how remote the evidence is. Pretty much all of the evidence we have from antiquity is filtered through men, either at the time, so either written by male authors in ancient Greece, or because of the way that written material especially is transferred to the modern day, they've been written down by male scholars for thousands and thousands of years. So I'm in this position of trying to tease out what I can of what it was like to be a woman in antiquity, and then this project comes along which is looking at women in predominantly the 19th and 20th centuries, and there's so much more evidence for me, from my perspective, than the material I'm normally used to looking at, and I'm suddenly getting to investigate these stories that are so interesting and inspiring in a way that I would never be able to do with my own research. So it's kind of, it comes from a similar place of interest, but it's just a sort of general interest in uncovering these stories and bringing them to light, and that kind of element of research.
And so is it just two of you that work on the show, or do you also have your own researchers, or is it just you two?
Yeah, so well, we produce the episodes, but part of what we really like to do is we basically just ask people, we send out ads and calls for contributors. We ask people to come forward with women that they are interested in and that they have heard of or that have inspired them, and they come to us, and they produce the research, and each episode is a conversation with that researcher. And we really wanted to do that so that we weren't just listing a load of women or bringing up a list of women on the internet and then assigning them to people, but we really want to engage with people who've been inspired by them. So then in the episode itself, we can talk about, you know, what legacy does that woman have? What, you know, how has she inspired you today? And there's that real personal connection that we can talk about as well.
So tell me about a story that's particularly, for both of you then, because I'm quite interested to see whether you both have different views on how you can increase female participation or representation. But is there, for both of you, is there a particular story which sort of resonates and is very powerful and effective as a broadcast tool as well?
Well, I think we were I was sort of thinking about whether there was one particular woman who I'd found more interesting or inspiring than the rest. And we are currently on our sixth episode.
Yeah, fifth episode.
And each episode, there has been something about that particular person which has been so different and so inspiring, which we might see parallels with other people, but also is something quite individual and unique. So it's quite hard to isolate one particular individual and say, this has been the person that I've thought has been most appropriate. So I've been hugely inspired by, for instance, the one that we specifically researched was Dr. Merz Tate, who was the first female African American member of the university. And she had this incredibly pioneering career in which she was the first African American graduate at her high school. She went on to be the first graduate from her her college, and all these sort of firsts all the way along down the line. But that was just kind of a necessity of her life. She didn't set out to be this pioneering woman. It was just that she had something that she wanted to achieve, and she happened to be the first African American woman to try and achieve those things in those particular institutions. And that's so I was sort of sitting in 2017 at the time thinking, my God, you know, she was incredibly brave to do all of these things, but for her it was just a matter of following her passion and following what her interest was. It was, although you can never remove the politics from this situation, it was also a very personal thing for her.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And what do you think then as well? Do you agree with that?
Yeah, I absolutely agree that there's, every single time we sit down with a researcher to record an episode, we kind of read through all the research that they've produced and think, wow, she just was really cool, basically. And they've all got so much stuff to add. And I also have really enjoyed looking at women from outside the university as well. So one episode we worked with a local historian, Liz Woolley, on Olive Gibbs,
mm-hmm.
who is a local politician. She was incredibly active in kind of local Labour politics in Oxford. She was Lord Mayor of Oxford, and she was also one of the founding members of CND. And she just, her whole life was just, she was, you know, contributed to building Oxford into the place it is now. And it was really great to kind of see her, because often I think when we talk about women's history in Oxford, there's a tendency to focus on the university. I think that's probably a consequence of the domination of the university in the town, and also the availability of records and the perspective of us as academics as well. But it's been really enlightening to look at these local women and seeing how all those, you know, they're connected, you know, university and town.
You talk about those records as well. Mm. So because people won't know this, but is there sort of a starting point to female history in Oxford then? Is there a point where you start getting more records in it? Because obviously you say about, in the classical side of things, is men writing about men.
Yeah.
Mm. Is there an instance where we have the beginning of, you know, more women appearing in the records, in historical material, in newspaper cuttings? Is there any indication of when that's happening?
Mm. But we've talked about this a lot, actually, because we've noticed that all of our episodes to date are, I think the earliest is early 19th century. We haven't got anything earlier than that. And we were trying to kind of suss out exactly why that is. And again, I think it's because a lot of the records we have are university-based. So a lot of the kind of milestones, if you look up women in Oxford's history, you're going to get when they were first admitted to get degrees, which was in 1920, when the first women's college was founded, which was in the late 19th century. And the actual kind of lives of women in the town are not as consistently recorded. And that's also a consequence, I think, of what we have decided to record historically. So, you know, other than a lot of the time, women were the ones who were in domestic arrangements or were behind the scenes a little bit more. They were not as prominent in public life, perhaps, in the earlier years. And so thus we just don't have as strong a record of them. I'm not sure if you'd agree on that.
Yes, yeah.
Yeah.
Sorry, I had zoned out because I just realised that I made a factual error in one of the things that I told you. So
No, tell us, we don't want fake news on the programme.
Yeah, no. I realised that Dr. Merz Tate was not the first African-American graduate. She was the only one in her class at Blanchard High. But she was the first African-American graduate of her college rather than her high school.
There we go. See, we clarified that. That's very good.
My apologies.
No, it's fine. When you sort of, you know, you want contributions to this podcast and everything, what sort of women do you have coming to you then? As in, like, what are the sorts of people you say, you know, are these people who have deep convictions, are angry about the state of things at the moment or historically?
Mm.
What sort of, you know, where are they from? You know, what are their issues they're passionate about? Because it seems to be something that is, it's a very very sort of broad territory you can approach from. You have, it seems like you have a lot of different people coming on, you're talking about a lot of different things. So is it not just a personal thing for them as well to talk about somebody they inspired by?
Yeah, definitely. And I think some of our contributors have been amazing in terms of the local connection, as in the personal connection for them. I don't think we've ever had anyone angry. The programme has never been militant. It's just been people being inspired by the incredible lives that these women have led and then deciding to come and share them with us. I think Lily, who came to speak to us about Iris Murdoch, is a perfect example of that. Her episode was very heartfelt. She just was so inspired by this woman that she learnt about, who I think most people know in a very abstract sense as a writer, and you might know the more scandalous kind of stories about her personal life, which we've had come up an awful lot actually when we've been researching women. It's often when these stories are in the public consciousness, it's been their sort of the fact that she had extramarital relationships, for instance, for Iris's, in Iris's case. And she was just so inspired by Iris's passion and freedom of in her life and her writing that captures that energy and that spirit of her. And that's one of the things that's very nice about the show, is that we get these people who just care so much about these women, and that doesn't remove their objectivity. I think they can still talk with the kind of historical perspective to make sure that they're doing a fair and accurate portrayal of the woman involved. But it does just add an extra kind of spirit to it that I think is quite moving sometimes.
And if you look then, I think the fact is that fewer than a quarter of the blue plaques in Oxford actually commemorating women. This is quite a funny thing, because in Wales, very, very male-dominated country, my upbringing was very sort of male-oriented. And you look at male voice choirs and rugby teams, and it's all very, very male. But recently, the First Minister in Wales has announced that there'll be purple plaques for women, and there's lots of different things. What do you think of that? Like, are plaques actually... First of all, because we have that happening in Oxford, and then we have this the Welsh thing to promote women and, you know, commemorate women and the statues and whatever. But the physical side of it, and the practical side of it, physical identification of a woman's contribution or where they lived or whatever, is that what you think can actually bring awareness?
Yes, absolutely. I think that the plaque scheme is one of the best ways to just put on the side of a building that these women lived here and they did something fantastically interesting. Like Felicia Skeen was a really good example for me. She has a blue plaque on St Michael Street or Newman Hall Street?
Yes, like the corner of the two.
The corner of the two. Yeah. I'd walk down that road 100 times and I'd never looked at it because I'm the kind of person who just doesn't notice blue plaques. And then suddenly when I walk past it every time I see it now, I'm sort of inspired to think there was this incredible woman doing these incredible things. And that's a real visual reminder for me. And for other people, you might imagine they might see the plaque and think, who is she? What did she do? You know, and go and look up her life. I'm not sure how much I would want to have a separate set of plaques just for women. I think one of the good things about the blue plaque scheme, although I think it is, I did a quick count on the website last night, and it is about 1 in 5 of the people who have blue plaques within Oxford itself are women. I think that number is small, but I think it's important to show that they have contributed to a society as a whole rather than sort of delineating them off and making them their own separate group. I don't know if you would agree.
Yeah, we've talked about this as well, actually, about what it is that we're doing when we're looking just at women within the podcast. And we kind of wanted to get across that we're not suggesting that there's history and then there's women's history, but that, you know, women have consistently and throughout history contributed to society. But that, you know, in order to really bring them back into the mainstream kind of historical narrative, we are going to have to pay concentrated attention to them and actively seek them out and look for the evidence and bring out their stories, which is why we do this podcast. But we're not trying to suggest that, you know, women are just a separate thing that we look at on their own.
Yeah, but it seems as well, if you look at the plaques and commemorating people, what you guys are doing with the podcast actually seems like sort of the modern way of commemorating people. Do you know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, what I'm interested in is, aside from this podcast and aside from the plaques, in the age that we're living in now, and you sort of go on the website and see things and, you know things down. What do you guys think about how you can promote the history of women in the present day, whether it's through policies or whether it's through physical identification? What do you think is the best way we can go about it, whether it's through social media? I'm not sure what you both of you think about that.
I think programs like the podcast, and I think initiatives on social media to make people more aware of that there are stories like this out there, really helps. But as still a lot of this material, people have to seek it out in a way that you might not necessarily. Someone has to have an interest in local history, perhaps, or stumble across it and think, "Oh, that looks interesting." I think there are definite good steps in the direction of including women more generally in the way that history is taught. But I don't know, it's certainly for the way archaeology is taught, women's studies is a specific unit within
gender, generally, as well.
Exactly. And I think reflecting on my undergrad experience, certainly, although women would occasionally stick their head around the door in terms of the historical narratives we were looking at, you kind of had to seek it out yourself and choose the options yourself in order to, or even choose to write the essays yourself. Sometimes, you know, you might have, there was one particular module at undergrad that I had a choice of two essays for the week, and one of them was the only essay looking at women in the whole term that we did, and most people chose to do the other essay, which was about pyramids, because okay, pyramids are pretty cool, like if you had the choice. But that's it's that kind of thing that a lot of the time, even at undergraduate level, you're having to make the active choice to learn about women's history, and it's not being built into the curriculum itself or the topics themselves. And it might be different in more modern history, but certainly in ancient history, I think there should be, if possible, a more of a concerted effort to make women's history part of just the everyday course, and stop earmarking it as this kind of weird thing that I think people find quite begrudging that they have to do. You know, try and reunite the narratives within the wider study of a subject.
And do you think then, if you look at the media as well and how the debates are framed then, because you have programs like Women's Hour and Loose Women, a bit different, both of them, but they are sort of programs focused on women as well. Mm-hmm. So, like, do you think that helps the debate at all, like those sorts of programs?
Yeah, well, I mean, like I said before, I think there's, in order to sort of bring awareness to women's lives, whether historically or in the present day, we have to pay attention to women, and that's not going to come naturally. That requires active efforts on behalf of individual people, and it, you know, involves actively creating space for women. Mm-hmm. And so if that's in the form of, you know, Women's Hour or Loose Women, then that's great. But I think the ultimate aim, obviously, is to have a more inclusive, you know, view of society and of history, that in which we don't need to have these separate spaces, and that in which we're able to sort of think about things in a much more diverse way, and, you know, not assuming a default that it's a white middle-class male.
Exactly. And if you look then at the response in Oxford that you've had, what's it been like from students and staff generally? What's the sort of, what's it been like?
I think everyone who's learned about the project has found it very interesting and been really excited to get involved if they can. I've roped a lot of friends in who've come and spoken to us about various subjects. Our reaction has been overwhelmingly positive. I don't think we've had any negative reaction. And if anything, the only thing we've had is surprise that it doesn't already exist, that this isn't something that's already being covered in some way or another. And that was one of the things that I was thinking about when you think more generally about the history of women in Oxford and in the university. If you try and research this stuff on your own, if you just did a Google search of like women in Oxford, you would get important alumni of the university or everything would be very university focused, whereas what we're trying to do is talk about the city as a whole. And that, I think, people have responded to very well, very strongly.
And if I can bring it then from the past into the present, and looking at the issues that women in Oxford face now generally, what are they?
Oh.
Because there was a recent...
There's
a big question, because there's sort of big issues. If you look at, if I can bring it back to the university, you know, the women, I think, undergraduate courses, women are offered, more women are offered more places than men.
This year, for the first time.
First time, and I don't know how much significance you give that story in terms of the practical changes to women and their decision-making and their right to feel empowered. We've got our, you know, female vice-chancellor. We had Dame Helen Goschier, female master of Balliol, the first one. Mm-hmm. Recently, Dame Hilary Balding became the first female president of Trinity College. I don't know if these big, you know, these big positions going to women make the difference in your eyes, or are there sort of issues that everyday undergraduates, postgraduates, academic staff, people around the city face?
Yes and yes. I think that's the thing. You can't just... I think there is this temptation to be like, now we have a female vice chancellor, that means that all sexism in Oxford is over, and it's not the case
at all.
You
still see that sort of sexism then?
It is part of the female experience that I think most people don't realise, and that common use of the word microaggression, that it's very, very difficult to explain, that it's one tiny comment said 100 times or a funny look sometimes accumulating over a course of a term, that it really starts to wear you down. I think the other thing I would also say is that I certainly am a white middle class woman in Oxford. I imagine my time is much, much easier than many, many of the other women who are here. Mm. And I mean, I don't know that much about... I know that there are 11 heads of house in the colleges now who are women. Are any of them anything other than middle class and white? Well, that's the other aspect, I would say, is that even if we have these small... not small victories, substantial victories in some ways for women across the university, we're still promoting the stories and the experiences of one very specific type of woman. And I think that is... You can't suddenly be like, sexism is over because we have... you know, one particular person in power who is a woman. I think we have to talk about not just keeping the momentum and keeping women in these positions, but also addressing how that particular type of person has become so much more common in positions of power than perhaps others.
Well, maybe I can ask then, just to follow up then, two things from there. Looking at that sort of sexism that you described and how the microaggression stuff comes into it. And you don't want to sort of layer different levels of sexism, because sexism is sexism. Mm-hmm. But do you think then that there, first of all, that there's this unwitting sort of casual way of behaving now that's a product of history? It's sort of normalised. These people don't realise that they're being sexist.
I think particularly within Oxford, that might more be the case. We were talking about this in regards to perception of gender at Oxford as well, because we were thinking about in terms of things like the Bullingdon Club, which is an extreme example, obviously, and I'm not saying that is the common experience of male undergraduates or female undergraduates at Oxford, but A, it is the perception of Oxford a lot of the time, I think, is that these incredibly elite, incredibly masculine, incredibly sort of violent societies still exist, and B, there are elements of that does bleed into other aspects of Oxford's life that I think you might not realise elsewhere. I don't know if you've ever had this experience, but being in a pub late at night with a very, very rowdy all-male football team, for instance, and you start to see these parallels in not feeling like it's a safe space for you to be in that environment.
And just for what you mentioned there, do you think then, looking at, if I can, like the broad issue of gender as well that you mentioned, what do you think you've seen then of the other experiences of women? So, as I said, we had Pamela Robertson here talking about how it's not just, for example, you know, it's difficult to look at women broadly, but look at, you know, black women, disabled women. Mm. Is that something that you think there needs to be more of a discussion around, just particularly now in the modern day, where there are more discussions like you guys are starting? Mm. Do you think that needs to be brought into the debate too?
Yeah, absolutely, 100%. I think we are really trying with this podcast not to further the idea that it's just white middle-class women in Oxford, and that's the type of woman that is in Oxford, and that's the type of women that's been in Oxford's history. We really want to kind of get across the real diversity, not only of, you know, race, but also class, like you say, disability. We'd like to also, you know, include a lot of LGBT women. We're really kind of looking for these women to include, because we don't want to perpetuate, you know, the idea that women is the default of white middle class women. But having said that, we've talked about this a lot, about the difficulties we face in trying to bring those people in, is that it's really a question of finding them in the historical record, which is what we've come up against. I'm not saying they're not there, they're 100% there. It's just accessing the evidence and finding them and bringing their stories to light, which takes actually just a lot of time and a lot of effort to find them. Mm. And I think it's something really important and that we would really like to do and commit more of our time to, mm, is to air stories of, yeah, not white middle-class women.
Exactly. And there are sort of, yeah, there's a recent exhibition, I think, in the Western Library talking about it.
Wonderful exhibition.
Yeah. Mm. Yeah, and so that's an example of, like, a, you know, a practical thing happening, which, yes, is, mm, something to celebrate. But do you think then, aside from that, which is excellent, does there need to be some sort of cultural shift then, generally, like in the way we talk about, you know, pronouns and terms. Obviously, I remember coming up to Oxford and Freshers Week and the workshops you go through, which are, you know, so important to understand things. You know, I, in all honesty, when you come up from university, I think anyone would say from any background, you do. This is the sort of first point you do actually learn about, you know, what this century is and what society is like and the way it is right to behave and like how things can offend people and how you should behave, really. But do you think there does need to be sort of a cultural change? Not just, you know, some people are going to completely not listen to some of these things. So does there need to be sort of a shift generally in society and how we behave, not just as men and women, but as people and the way we treat each other? Do you think that needs to happen?
Yeah, but I think it is happening. I think all these things are evidence of, I mean, things like my undergrad here started in 2010, so I've been here for the last 8 years. When I came up as an undergrad, sexual consent workshops were not a common thing, whereas now it's my understanding that most undergrads will go through
one. All of them do that.
Yeah, and that is an example within, you know, the last 5 years or so that there has been this huge shift in addressing problems that were just not spoken of when I was first.
Who spurred that on, do you think? Because I know obviously the Me Too movement has come along now. Mm-hmm. And it perpetuates any sort of debate, rightly, in any industry now. Mm-hmm. And women, you know, from what I understand it, you know, looking at from the outside, people do feel quite empowered to talk about things. But is there, you know, you saw whether recently this has happened. You know, we're still a decade into the 21st century, and it seems quite strange that this hasn't been happening. So I don't know whether there was that cultural shift. You said that there was happening. It's starting to happen now.
I think it's been happening for a really long time, and I think these things they might not have to be, but they tend to be extremely gradual. And that's one of the things that I think that's so important about revisiting women's history is things that to us nowadays might seem completely commonplace, like 50 or 100 years ago might have been completely unthinkable. And so, for instance, one of the things that we were looking at today, the first female MP in Oxford was 2010, was Nicola Blackwood. And we just thought that was astonishing. We thought there must have been somebody before that. But we went and sat and did all the looking at the Wikipedia articles and everything, and there wasn't. And if you think about even... That's like you say, 10 years into the 21st century, and there's still these positions of power that are still not going to women. I mean, they are now. I mean, both of Oxford West and Oxford East are female MPs as of 2017, which I think demonstrates that these developments do happen. So I think you have to recognise that cultural shifts do not happen overnight. I think that you have to celebrate all the small victories of women through history, which is part of what we're trying to do. But then you also have to keep pushing forward to... there's no resting on your laurels and this kind of thing. You have to keep making sure that the change that you want to see in order to make it a more fair and balanced environment for all genders continues to happen.
And for both of you then, before we finish, I'm quite interested to see if you have different views on this. But going forward with this podcast, and I'm not sure how long you'll be doing it for and who will take over.
Well, neither are we.
So looking at the future of this particular initiative then, you know, what do you hope to achieve at the end of it? Because it seems as if there's immense progress being made, there's an immense impact being made about this. Is there anything else that you think you, but also students, could be doing to engage with these sorts of issues? As I've mentioned that this is, it seems like the modern way of communicating these important issues. I don't know, going forward, what you think could change in terms of the way you get out there or the way you bring people in. What do you think?
I think it's actually, I kind of agree with what Alice says about it's celebrating small victories and just plugging away. So you talk about needing a cultural shift or an attitude shift. Those things come about because people are putting in the work. And I think I would just like to give the contribution that I can give in putting in that work and just putting out podcast episodes every month and having people listen to them and hopefully, you know, spreading the word, you know, the biggest audience we can have, you know, the better. But I think really it's just plugging away and just hoping that, you know, the cultural shifts come and, you know, normalising these sorts of things and bringing things into the conversation is what's important.
Definitely. I think one of the kind of things that's nice about the podcast is although we are featuring an individual woman every month, it is focusing on an individual. What you end up with is a coherent story of lots and lots of women who all show that all these sometimes small, sometimes monumental shifts contributions, sorry, lead to a wider shift in society, and that's what's quite nice about it. And I feel like we are just, although we haven't achieved some of the incredible things that these women have achieved, we are part of this huge network of women across Oxford who are really trying to change things in the smallest way, in the way that they can. And that's, I think it's natural to want one person to represent a huge change, and I think they can, but I think it's also about the small contributions that you yourself can make. So for me, it's like if two or three people pick up the podcast and learn about someone that they didn't know, and they walk past the plaque of Felicia Skeen on St. Michael's Street and think she did something amazing, then that's what this can mean, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I certainly would say that Oxford Radio supports you fully.
Thank you very much.
And so how can people, we'll put the links and everything on the website, but how can people listen to this? Where is it? Where do they go and listen? How do they get involved?
So we actually have two different ways that you can get involved. We have a website, which is womenofoxford.org, that we put up blog posts, which are written format versions of the episodes that we produce. We also produce everything as an audio episode, as a traditional podcast, which you can find wherever you get your podcasts, whether it's through iTunes or SoundCloud or whatever. We also have a fairly active Twitter presence at Women of Oxpod.
Yes.
So that will, if you're a Twitter person, you can follow us there, and we'll post links to all the episodes and everything as well.
Yeah.
Well, that's absolutely brilliant. Bethany White, Alice Parkin, thank you so much for coming in. Certainly inspirational story and important work being done in Oxford. So I'm delighted to have you both in here. Thank you so much for your time. That's all we've got time for on this week's episode on Oxford Today. We'll be back next week with another scintillating discussion with people around Oxford. But from me, Theo, Bethany and Alice, goodbye.